How nutritious are school lunches?
New treatments for high potassium.
What can we do about those chronic coughs?
In comparison of two medications for treating Marfan patients.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on November 28, 2014. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and president of the Texas Tech University Health Science Center in El Paso and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, since I suggested the study that's relative or the several studies that are relative to school lunches, I'd like to start with that one. That's in the current issue of JAMA Pediatrics. Should you pack it or should you buy it? It seems to come down to.
All right. So there were two studies that looked at school lunches. One looked at the quality of lunches brought from home and the cost. And the other looked at impacts of a breakfast in the classroom program. Elizabeth, how do you want to package this?
Oh, boo. I think that we should start first with breakfast, since breakfast comes first.
All right. There's been school breakfast programs available for many years now. Unfortunately, the participation is not as good as we'd like. For example, only about 40% of low-income students would qualify for the school breakfast program actually participate. And there are a lot of barriers to that. One is the stigma attached with it. The other is there are some logistics. The children have to get there before school. So what about actually serving the breakfast actually in the classroom? So a total of 257 schools in several large urban U.S. school districts implemented a breakfast in the classroom program during the 2012-2013 academic year, whereas 189 did not. And what they showed was breakfast in classroom program was linked with a marked increase in participation. It was about 74% in schools that had the breakfast in classroom program versus about 43% in the schools that didn't. This program was also linked with greater overall school attendance rates, although there was no difference in cognitive measures. That's not terribly surprising because it's a relatively short study. Conversely, when you talk about lunches, we know that schools have not only provided lunches, but more recently there's been a marked improvement in the nutrition. So there are more vegetables and more fruits and more whole grains and less sugar and carbohydrate products. So the next study compared lunches brought from home containing school lunch programs that are recommended by the National School Lunch Program Guideline. And what they discovered was if the lunch was brought from home, it more likely contained more sodium, fewer servings of fruit, fewer servings of vegetables, fewer servings of whole grains, and milk. In fact, 90% of the lunches brought from home contained desserts, snack chips, and sweetened beverages, which are not permittable in the school lunch programs.
How very interesting. And so to me, it sounds like a major barrier to the adoption of these programs on a more widespread basis would be, let's just make it global. Let's have all the kids have breakfast and lunch at school. And then that way, we know that the nutritional value is there. And we also remove stigma from the program.
That certainly sounds like a very attractive model. It obviously is somewhat costly, but I agree that if you made sure that every child had breakfast, the studies show that the test performance and school attendance rates go up, tardiness goes down, and we can actually control nutrition better. So while I don't disagree, I think it'd be awfully costly to implement.
However, we could say there's a sliding scale. If your family's income is such that you can afford to purchase those things, then we ask that you do that. And that could even be incremental, depending on the income of the family.
That's a terrific solution. That way, it doesn't have an undue economic burden upon society, but at the same time, ensures that everybody has the same nutritional value. I like that, Elizabeth.
I bet these lunches are a lot better than the ones I remember. I can remember mystery meat. How about you?
I can too. You didn't know what it was. You were afraid to eat it.
But if you were hungry, you probably did it anyway. Let's turn from here to something that you just had to take a pause to do. That was cough. What about chronic cough treatments? That's in the current issue of The Lancet.
This is a neat study because it identifies new mechanisms and possible new therapies for what's known as chronic cough. That's a cough that's persisted for 8 weeks or longer. It affects their quality of life. It affects their sleep. It affects how they feel throughout the day. The most recently approved therapy was dextromethorphan, which was approved 50 years ago. It only decreases cough about 12%. What these authors exploited was a recognition there are certain receptors called P2X3 receptors on vagus nerves that probably trigger the cough. They identified an antagonist to it and provided it to individuals that had chronic cough. This is a double-blind, placebo-controlled crossover study. They took 24 patients who had a chronic cough. They randomized them to receive either placebo or this P2X3 receptor antagonist. It's called AF219, and they did that for 2 weeks. And they actually had a machine on them to monitor cough. And then they switched each group. And what they discovered was this new receptor antagonist decreased cough by 75%. And in fact, that was by intention to treat. But if you actually looked at people who actually received therapy, it decreased cough by 85%.
What a really wonderful thing. We have been struggling with this for so long. So many people do have chronic cough and have so much trouble. So before we talk about side effects, I have to say to these folks, hey, something other than P2X3, it just doesn't sound too marketable to me. It's going to have to be employed. And also for the name of the medication, clearly.
Absolutely. And so it'll have some sexy name, I'm sure. Now, you mentioned side effects. There is a P2X2 receptor on our tongue. That is, it's a close cousin of this receptor responsible for cough. And at the high doses that this antagonist was given, it not only suppressed the cough, but it also caused unusual taste or taste disturbance. 6 patients of the 24 actually stopped the medication just because they didn't like the unusual taste. That shows there's room for improvement. Either we can decrease the dose of this medication or perhaps give more specific receptors. We don't know the long-term side effects or the safety, but still, it's a new mechanism, holds a lot of promise.
Outstanding, and just in time for cough season. Let's turn from here then to the New England Journal of Medicine. Here at Johns Hopkins, of course, we've been doing research for many years on Marfan syndrome. Now we're going to take a look at a medication known as Losartan, or a beta blocker for management of that condition.
Marfan syndrome affects approximately 1 in 5,000 people, and it's a condition where the connective tissue, that is the tissue that holds things together, becomes progressively more fragile and degenerates over time. And the leading cause of death is actually the aorta enlarging and actually dissecting. People can bleed to death or have acute heart failure from one of the leaky valves, and that's the leading cause of death. Since about 1994, we've used beta blockers as therapy. What beta blockers do is they slow the heart rate a bit, they lower the blood pressure a bit, they decrease the force upon which the blood is ejected into the aorta. Well, because of work done at Hopkins, they identified the mechanism by which Marfan occurs, and there are medications, particularly angiotensin receptor blockers like Losartan, that specifically affect the pathway. And it's thought that these would be more effective than beta blockers. So what this study did was they looked at 608 Marfan patients, and they randomized them to either receive beta blocker or to Losartan. And what they discovered when they followed these individuals over the course of 3 years is that there was no difference in aortic enlargement between the beta blocker versus Losartan.
Would you suggest that there would be any benefit to using these two agents together?
Elizabeth, that is a great question. Unfortunately, this study didn't address it, but smaller studies have suggested that the combination, because they act in two different ways, may be better than a beta blocker alone. So I think that's the next direction that the study should take.
For right now, then, what do you suggest with regard to people who have Marfan?
Well, I think that if you're going to use a single agent, you can use the one that's best tolerated by the particular patient. Will both be better than either one alone? I think that's still up for study.
And so we'll be talking about it again. Finally, in the New England Journal of Medicine, let's turn to treatment for hyperkalemia or high potassium.
This is a particularly common condition in patients who have chronic kidney disease. You say, well, what's the harm? Well, if it gets too high, it actually causes irregular heart rhythm and can be responsible for arrhythmic deaths as well. We know that if we put them on an angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitor or an angiotensin receptor blocker, they can actually slow the progression of kidney disease. They're also beneficial in people that have diabetes, and unfortunately, high potassium occurs in those circumstances. You put people on these medications and they actually raise the potassium more. So the medications you'd like to use, you can't. So there were two different studies in the New England Journal looking at different medications that actually absorb potassium and exchange it for either sodium or calcium. And these two different compounds were tested in two different patient groups. They all had elevated potassium. And in both of these different studies, they were effective in lowering the potassium to the normal range in about 3/4 of individuals. They did so in 2 to 3 days. This is what the editorialist calls a new era for the treatment of hyperkalemia.
This, of course, at first blush, appears to be good news. My question is, what happens to these folks when they're on the stuff for a while?
Unfortunately, the studies don't address that because these patients just took the medications for a number of weeks. So there's still some more studies to be done for proof of concept. I think this is still very encouraging news for a huge number of patients that are affected with chronic kidney disease and diabetes.
Indeed. On that good news note, then, I'll reveal that I'm going to do the school lunches on the blog this week.
Elizabeth, I'd like to give a hi to one of our listeners, Nathan Moore. Nathan and his co-author, Elizabeth Askin, wrote a great primer called The Healthcare Handbook. And I just saw Nathan at a recent conference, and he's one of our listeners. I told him I'd just wave a hi to him on the podcast.
Shout out. Okay, we're shouting out to you, Nathan. And Nathan, we'll wish you a happy Thanksgiving. Hope you'll read the blog. That's going to be on the school lunches this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.